Well, we almost finished last time, but there's still three slides left before you get we finish this unit. Did everyone get Scantron forms? Remember to show up with one, at least one, on Wednesday. When we stopped on Wednesday, I was just defining in general what a functional group is, which is, remember, is not a whole molecule. A functional group is just a part of a molecule. It's a certain collection of atoms in a certain configuration. And we call them functional groups because if a molecule has a certain functional group, the molecule overall will have certain functions because of that functional group. Now it's time to actually survey the functional groups in, if this were the book, one table, but the one table spans two slides, as you see, 11 and 12. I just want to say one more time, though, that keep in mind that the functional groups are responsible for not only for Wednesday's test, but also for the lab. Okay, let's notice, before I get into each one specifically, that every functional group is pictured two different ways, as a ball and stick model and as a chemical formula. And notice that each of those versions, the ball and stick and the chemical formula, you can tell by looking at it, it's not a complete molecule. Why is that? How do you know just by looking at it, it's not a complete molecule?
You can see a bond coming off of it that's going to nothing.
Right. There's an uncompleted bond. So that just shows you that it's part of a molecule. Now, there's two different ways you can actually draw this, the chemical formula. Some books will do it just as a dash, meaning a bond with whatever else. And some will use an R instead. So for this first one, for instance, R-OH is the same thing as nothing-OH. When the R is used, and a lot of books do use it, it stands for residue, which simply means what's left over, meaning everything else that's in the atom besides that functional group. And also, by the way, it doesn't matter where the R is. It doesn't have to be on the left side. You could also write this first one as, instead of R-OH, you could write it as HO-R. But notice that you couldn't write it as OH-R or R-HO. Why are these ones incorrect? Well, it would be, but it's not even possible. Why are these two completely wrong?
Because they each can't bond. They can only bond with one other element.
That's right. Because of what? It has a valence of one. Hydrogen has a valence of one. So it can never make multiple bonds. It's already making one with oxygen. When you don't have any dash, by the way, between two chemical symbols, like H and O, that also implies a bond between them. You could write that as R-O-H, for that matter. It's just shorthand to just write it as OH. Okay, yeah, so these are nonsense. Hydrogen can't form two bonds. All right, well, let's go look at these one at a time. And the first one, as you see, is the hydroxyl group, which is an OH with the oxygen involved, making its second bond. Remember, oxygen always makes two bonds because its valence is two. One of those bonds is with the hydrogen. The other one is with the residue or the rest of the molecule. And we see these in a lot of different molecules. And therefore, there is a category of molecules, namely all of those that contain a hydroxyl group. If a substance contains a hydroxyl group, then it's classified as an alcohol. Now, we're used to thinking about one alcohol, whether it's in beer, wine, spirits. That's all ethanol. It's the same chemical if you're drinking an alcoholic beverage. But there are many, many alcohols. That's just one example. Anything with a hydroxyl group is an alcohol. And usually alcohols are given names that end in OL, just like the word alcohol, to tell you that it's an alcohol. Like ethanol. This one is ethanol. That's the alcohol of alcoholic beverages. By the way, it gets its name ethanol because it's ethane-like alcohol. If instead of having this hydroxyl, this is just simply another hydrogen, then that would be ethane, the two-carbon hydrocarbon that we talked about in an earlier slide. But it's just like ethane, except it's an alcohol. So it's ethyl alcohol or ethanol. The reason these are biologically important is because just like in water, which of course also has OH bonds, right, two of them per water molecule, OH makes for a polar functional group for the same reason. Why is OH polar? Oxygen has a fairly significantly higher electronegativity compared to hydrogen. And therefore, the pair of electrons that are shared by the O and the H are not shared equally. Just like in water, we talked about the importance of that polarity. Well, alcohols are at least slightly polar because they have that hydroxyl. Next up is the carbonyl group, which you can see features a carbon double bonded to an oxygen. That takes care of two of the four bonds that carbon has to form to satisfy its valence. This is a little bit unusual compared to the other functional groups because there are two unsatisfied bonds, two sticks hanging off of the ball and stick figure. Or you could write it as two R's if you use the R notation. Because of that, there's two major categories of ways in which a carbonyl can appear in a molecule. It has to have the carbon double bonded to the oxygen. But notice that carbon is part of carbonyl. Of course, that's why it was named that. And we've already talked about any given organic compound's carbon skeleton, right? The collection of carbons that make it up. Everything else is hanging on to that carbon skeleton. Well, in this case, the carbon that's part of the functional group, carbonyl, is also part of the carbon skeleton. And therefore, there are two ways that the carbon that's part of the carbonyl group can be positioned within that skeleton. Those two ways are pictured here. One way is that the carbon of the carbonyl group, highlighted in periwinkle or whatever color this is, that carbon is at a tip of the skeleton, some tip. This skeleton happens to have two tips, but if there's branching, there can be multiple tips of the skeleton, right? That's one possibility, that the carbonyl of the carbonyl group is at a tip of the carbon skeleton. The other one is not at a tip. Doesn't matter that it's in the middle, it's just anywhere other than the tip, than a tip, I should say. All right, those are two major possibilities. And therefore, we don't give just one name to one category containing carbonyls. There are two major kinds of substances, depending on where that position is. And those are called aldehydes and ketones, which is spelled up there, but you probably can't see it. So aldehyde is not a single substance. Ketone is not a single substance. Those are categories, just like alcohol is. Now, the carbonyl that if a carbonyl in a molecule is at a tip, we call it an aldehyde. Like this one is propanal. Aldehydes get names that end in al to tell you they're aldehydes. Propanal, not propanol. Propanol is also stuff, but it's an alcohol, not an aldehyde. And if it's not at a tip, the carbonyl that is, then the compound is an example of a ketone, and ketones' names end in O-N-E, like acetone shown here. Now, I used to mix these up all the time, couldn't remember which category was which, but one day it dawned on me that the word aldehyde starts with an A, of course, and A is at one of the tips of the alphabet. Whereas ketone, starting with a K, well, K is in the middle of the alphabet somewhere. It's not at a tip. So maybe that'll help you. But those are the two categories. And those are big deals in biology for different reasons, but one of which is that you find these in monosaccharides all the time. And monosaccharides are a big deal in biology, as we'll get into after this first test. Third up is the carboxyl group, which is a little bit confusing at first when you're learning these functional groups, because the carboxyl group, as you see there in purple, looks like it's two different functional groups. It looks like it's a carbonyl group and a hydroxyl group. And actually it is, but when you have that particular arrangement, exactly as pictured there, we don't count it as two functional groups. Instead, this is one bigger functional group just by itself. Notice, though, that the name carboxyl tells you that it really is a combination of carbonyl and hydroxyl. It's the carboxyl is a portmanteau or a combination word. Don't consider it to be a hydroxyl, though, or a carbonyl. It is a carboxyl only. And carboxyl groups, substances that contain a carboxyl group are called either carboxylic acids, that's the better word, because it tells you that the carboxyl is in it, or they can be called organic acids. And the reason that name exists is because most acids are not organic. They don't have carbon in them, like hydrochloric acid. It's hydrogen and chlorine only. Or sulfuric acid, no carbon in it. Well, these, of course, do have carbon in it because carbon is part of the carboxyl group. Carboxylic acids are indispensable to life because I think I've mentioned a few times already that, and we'll get much deeper into this, all of the important functions that any cell, any type of cell, any organism performs requires proteins to do the important jobs. And proteins are large molecules that are made out of subunits called amino acids. Every amino acid has a carboxyl in it. So you can't have any protein without carboxylic acids, and therefore you can't have any life without without carboxyl groups. That's not an example. I'll just leave it at that, and we'll go on to the next slide. So next up is the amino group. And whenever you see the word or the root amino or amono or amine, you know that there is a nitrogen involved somehow. And you can see that in the picture here. The amino group is a nitrogen, which of course has a valence of 3, right? So it has to make 3 bonds total. In this case, that nitrogen that's part of the amino group is forming 2 bonds as single bonds with 2 different hydrogens. So it's an NH2. And then the third bond is with the residue. And a lot of things have these, but collectively, amino containing compounds are called amines. Well, I just got done telling you about how important carboxylic acids are because you can't have proteins without amino acids and you can't have amino acids without a carboxyl group. Well, every amino acid not only has a carboxyl, this is glycine, one kind of amino acid. You can see the carboxyl there that we were talking about. Every amino acid, though, also has an amino group. That's why they're called amino acids. Amino from the amino group and acid from the fact that they're also carboxylic acids because of the carboxyl group. So just as indispensable to life are the amines. Next up is sulfhydryl. And which one that we've already talked about is this very similar to? Right, it's very similar to a hydroxyl, except instead of being an OH, it's an SH. And why should that not surprise you? What I mean is, Yeah, they're in the same group, right, on the periodic table. S and O, that is, sulfur and oxygen. Elements in the same group, or column, have similar properties. And if you think back to your ball and stick procedure, you only had four different kinds of elements to work with, right? But you were supposed to make a molecule with sulfur in it. Well, you didn't just randomly choose one of your wooden balls, right? Which one did you use? No, you had oxygen, but... Oh, yeah, you used oxygen to denote sulfur, right? For that reason, it has similar properties. So just like OH can form, SH can form. And the combining form, or the word root that means sulfur, is thio. So when you see that in words, you mean that means there's a sulfur involved. Well, the group of compounds that have a sulfhydryl group are called thiols, which is a word that literally means sulfur-like alcohol. It's not truly an alcohol. OHs make alcohols, right? But SHs are chemically similar, and therefore they behave similar to alcohols, but they're called thiols instead. These are also important for reasons related to proteins. Some of the amino acids that make up proteins have a sulfhydryl group in them as well. Not all of them do, but some do. And a protein is many amino acids linked together, and then they fold up into three-dimensional shape, as we'll talk about. If you have two amino acids, each with a sulfhydryl in it, and doesn't matter where they are if you stretched it out, but when you let it fold into three dimensions, if those sulfhydryl groups come close to each other, each one will lose a hydrogen, another SH right here. They'll lose their hydrogens, and that will allow the two S's, the two sulfurs, to covalently bond. And that really stabilizes the three-dimensional shape of the protein because covalent bonds are strong. You have a lot of these in your hair, for example, which is why if you burn hair, it smells like sulfur because there's a lot of these sulfhydryl groups. Phosphate is next. And as far as the number and types of atoms, this is the most complex of the ones of the functional groups we'll study. This is not an exhaustive list of functional groups, by the way. You would learn more if you were in a biochemistry course. But this is all the ones that you'll be responsible for this course. And the phosphate is the most complex of them. Notice it has a central phosphorus atom. That's why that's the phosphate. Part of the word phosphate, of course. But it's not a phosphorus atom only. It's a phosphorus atom connected to four different oxygen atoms, one of which then makes the connection to the rest of the molecule. And phosphates, it's even harder to overestimate the importance of phosphates to life. Simply because there's multiple reasons why we can't live without them. They do a lot of different things in biology, but one of the reasons we can't live without phosphate is that every single building block of nucleic acids, which are DNA and RNA molecules, every single building block has a phosphate in it. So you can't have any DNA or RNA, and therefore no life. That alone is enough of a reason for it to be important. But also, you can't you wouldn't have any life because the first cells would never have come into existence without phosphate, because a cell is defined by the plasma membrane, right? The plasma membrane is the boundary between the cell and everything else, and a plasma membrane is a collection of molecules called phospholipids, each of which individually has a phosphate in it. So those the very first cells, even before they were living, the first cell-like structures that formed had to have these phospholipids available. Those accumulated in Earth's oceans over a period of time before there were so many that they started forming these little spheres that we'll talk about. So that's another reason. Also, phosphates can kind of be used as switches, molecular switches. This is known as phosphorylation and dephosphorylation, which simply means adding a phosphate group onto something or taking a phosphate off of something. Typically, that something that it's added to or taken off of is a protein of some sort, like an enzyme. Enzymes are proteins. And, you know, if you don't want a protein, like an enzyme, to work at the moment, you could destroy it. That'll keep it from working. But if the next moment you need it again, then you'd have to rebuild it, which is expensive and it takes time. It's much nicer to just be able to switch it off temporarily, switch it back on. And you can do that with phosphorylation and dephosphorylation. And then another reason I'll get to in the final slide, there's still yet another reason why we absolutely can't live without it. But that's enough for now. Next is methyl. That's the last of the functional groups you'll need to be responsible for. We find these in a lot of molecules. It's carbon, three hydrogens, and then the fourth bond for the carbon is the residue. The reason you find so many of these in organic compounds is that when you think of a carbon skeleton, there can be, especially if there's a lot of carbons in it, there can be many tips, right, depending on how many branches there are. And typically at a tip, unless there's some other kind of functional group, you complete the valence of the carbon simply by filling up with hydrogens if it's at a tip. So methyls, you find, if you look at the structural formula of a molecule with all the C's and all the other symbols, you find a lot of methyl groups. They can act as switches just like phosphates can, but for different kinds of molecules. Phosphorylation and dephosphorylation, it happens for proteins typically, switches on and off proteins. Methylation and demethylation, though, can be used as a switching mechanism for DNA, specifically for genes. So genes can be turned off so that they're not accessible by the cell, or turned on by methylation and demethylation. All right, that leaves just this final slide, 13, which is this other major reason why phosphate is so important to life. We're looking at a molecule of ATP here on the left. And what does ATP stand for? Right, adenosine triphosphate. It's an adenosine molecule, which would be a molecule by itself, but it's connected to three different phosphates. So adenosine triphosphate. And we'll be talking a lot more about this molecule in Unit 3, but it's often by books called the energy currency of cells. We temporarily store energy in the form of ATP molecules that we build because it's versatile. I say temporarily because almost as soon as we build it, we then unbuild it to release that energy to do something else in the cell that requires energy. And we'll learn about that later. But we invest it in energy by putting these phosphate bonds on. There's chemical energy stored in the bonds between phosphate molecules. And that energy comes from the food that you eat, which, when it's broken down, releases energy that can be used to build these molecules. But then when you want to use the ATP to do something that requires energy in the cell, you reverse the process of building it. And you therefore deconstruct it rather than build it. You take a phosphate off of an ATP, which is what's shown here as you go to the right. That makes ADP, adenosine diphosphate, and that breaking of the phosphate-phosphate bond releases the energy that was stored in there. And we'll look at the particulars of these in the unit this is important for, Unit 3, but I just want to alert you to the notation here. Be careful with this notation for a phosphate group. It's a P with a circle. P by itself is not phosphate. P by itself is a phosphorus atom. This is more than a phosphorus atom. P with the circle around it is just shorthand for the whole functional group, which is a phosphorus atom surrounded by four oxygen atoms. All right? But when you see the circle around the P, that's what it means. Not a phosphorus atom, a phosphate group. And by the way, when you have these phosphates that are connected to adenosine, you don't see the detail of adenosine, but adenosine is an organic compound. There's carbon in there, right? So when phosphate is part of that, it's part of an organic molecule. When you dephosphorylate ATP to form adenosine diphosphate, or ADP, and just a phosphate on its own, the phosphate on its own, notice, is called inorganic phosphate because it's not connected to a carbon skeleton anymore. It's just phosphorus and oxygen. That's what the I subscript means, a phosphate just on its own in solution. Okay. You are now armed with the knowledge for exam one. So unless you want to ask me questions about the test, we're done. Feel free to leave if you want, but if you have questions, you can ask me now.
Why do you lose the phosphate?
Well, you don't lose it. You just lose it from, it's no longer connected to the adenosine. So it's adenosine diphosphate plus the phosphate that's been picked off. It's still this phosphate. It's just in solution now by itself. Because that releases the energy that you've invested into it by building it to begin with. You know, if you reverse this process, which is right to left, that's what you do when you use the food that's the energy that's in your food originally. You use that energy to take an inorganic phosphate and hook it on to this to transform ADP into ATP. That stores the energy that was in your food, but now into this form. And then when you need to use that energy, you break apart the ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate. Anything else? Does the bookstore have plenty of Scantron forms, by the way? I've actually never been to the bookstore. Okay. They still sell little packets of six, which is perfect for the whole term. Six is good. All right, anything else? Yeah. All of them. It's 50. All five tests will be 50. So they're all the same size.
And will it cover the introductory
course week? Yes, it'll cover everything until this moment.
Okay.
And then when you look at the page that is the online slideshows, the synchronized slideshows,
yeah.
Notice that those are color-coded. Each color is one unit, which is one test's worth of stuff.
Okay.
And so unit 5, which is way off, unit 5, though, is not comprehensive. It's just the fifth test.
I will go to the students.